You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, March 9th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor Henry Farrell of George Washington University, on the failure of an internet libertarian paradise of sorts. Also on the program today, 47 Republican senators simultaneously announced they don't understand the Constitution and they are desperately afraid of losing Iran as a rhetorical boogeyman. Also on the program today, in Wisconsin, Scott Walker makes it official. Wisconsin has become a right to work with less rights and less pay state. And in Florida, climate change solved. The problem of climate change solved. Just don't talk about it anymore. And Donna Edwards set to announce her candidacy for Senate in Delaware. And a new revelation coming out of Ferguson about who it was that had sent some of those racist emails. Let me put it another way. Who was one of the people who kept sending racist emails? All that and more on today's program. Folks, just a little bit more house cleaning. You'll notice that we've tidied up some of the titling on the... No, that's not it, folks. Podcastawards.com. We need you to vote on a daily basis. Some people had emailed us and told us there were some problems last week with the voting. Podcastawards.com has assured us they have fixed the problem, but we lost a day or two of votes. I don't know if that happened system-wide with them or what, but we need you folks to be diligent about this. There's only so many times that we can vote here at the office. There's three of us. We vote every day, but that's it. We can't just go home and vote, although we've tried. But you can vote every day or once within every 24-hour period. So when we go to music break, go and vote, and then the next day you do it a minute later or seconds later. We need your votes. It's only a couple more weeks of voting, I think. Maybe you're not even that many. And it doesn't. They don't tell you when the voting period ends, do they?
They don't, do they?
No, they're sneaky that way. So we need your support. Podcastawards.com. Head down to Best Politics and News.
It does say now. Voting closes March 24th.
Okay, so you got a couple of weeks. But the thing is because you can do it every day, if you miss a day, then we are behind.
It's a big deal, yes. So it's good that it's far away, being that you have to vote every day and we could do this. We could pull this off.
Best news in politics. And while you're over there, People's Choice, Best of the Left. a show which has introduced many of you to this program. So it all helps build progressive media by heading over there. And occasionally it, you know, look, if it wasn't for podcast awards and our winning three times, I would have never gotten that letter threatening to sue me by a patent troll. And had I never gotten that letter threatening to sue me with a patent troll, I probably wouldn't have done Marin's program or That's WTF.
True. That's true.
And in which case then, you know, so all the sort of the benefits in building the show from there. I mean, so you never know. Next time I could get sued by somebody even bigger and more prominent.
And Sam could find himself on Louie.
That's right. That's right. All right, we've got to take a break. We'll be right back with Professor Henry Farrell.
Make a hole with a gun perpendicular to the name of this town in a desktop globe. Exit wound in a foreign nation, showing the home of the one this was written for. My apartment looks upside down from there. Water spirals the wrong way out the sink. And her voice is a backwards record. It's like a whirlpool. In the glow of each other's majestic presence. Listen in and hear my words. They're the ones you would think I would say if there wasn't me for you. All alone at the 64 World Fair. 80 dolls yelling, small girl, after all. Who was at the DuPont Pavilion? Why was the bench still warm? Who had been there? Or the time when the storm...
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of Political Science at George Washington University at the Elliott School there, Henry Farrell, who you also can catch blogging at places like Monkey Cage and Crooked Timber. Welcome to the program, Henry.
I'm delighted to be here.
So we're talking about your piece that you had in Aeon Magazine. I hope I haven't mispronounced that. We have a link at majority.fm. And it is about the attempts, I guess, to put into practice what we hear quite a bit, particularly on this program, from libertarians about an unregulated marketplace, free of the monopoly on force by a state. And you start with a place called the Hidden Wiki. What is that?
Well, the Hidden Wiki is one of a variety of sites and also places on forums like Reddit, for example, where you can find the basic addresses that allow you to reach hidden parts of the Internet. You need these addresses together with a special browser called the Tor browser, and together you can use them to access these websites in ways that make it pretty hard for people to monitor that you're accessing them, and also make it very hard for you to figure out where the website that you're actually accessing is located.
All right, and so now I think our audience is somewhat familiar with the Tor browser, but in the context of more sort of like dissident and civil liberties work. But tell us exactly what the Tor browser does and talk about that divide, I guess. There are two different sort of worlds that use it.
Yeah, very much. Well, there's a variety of different people who use it. And one of the problems, of course, is that because you cannot monitor who's using it, it's very hard to get a good sense of what uses it is being put to. And so you see a lot of dueling arguments and statistics going back and forth. But effectively, on the one hand, Tor browser is a wonderful tool to have if, for example, you are a dissident in a non-democratic regime. It allows you to access the Internet without your governments being able to tell what is happening. And so, for example, if you look back to the Arab Spring of a few years ago, you saw a huge increase in use of the Tor browser happening from Egypt precisely because people wanted to figure out what the hell was going on without their government being able to see what websites they were accessing. But also, by the same token, if you want to avoid government surveillance because you're interested, for example, in dubious criminal activities, Tor also provides you with the same kind of privacy, the same kind of freedom from surveillance. So it's a double-edged tool, like many technological tools, which has very positive and perhaps sometimes negative consequences too.
All right, so let's talk about what sort of grew out of that, and you talk about a dilemma that Tor presents, I guess, for some of those folks who want to engage in behavior that they don't want the state to see because it's illicit.
Well, I think that this is what it really does. It sharpens and accentuates a problem that all criminals have, which is fundamentally, you do not, by and large, if you're a criminal, you're probably not a particularly trustworthy individual. And if you're dealing with other criminals, they're probably not trustworthy either. So you are always trying to figure out how it is that you can make sure that you can protect yourself from the people who you're doing business with. And they also are probably trying to figure out the same kind of thing with regard to you. So that, for example, if you look at the Sicilian Mafia, the Italian sociologist Diego Gambetta has written a lot of wonderful work about how profound distrust is between mafiosi because they simply do not know that they can trust each other. And so what the internet does and these anonymous browsing techniques do is that on the one hand, they allow criminals to avoid the oversight of law enforcement, but also by the same token, these criminals are also anonymous to each other, which makes it much harder for them to trust each other, and which means, for example, if you're trying to do a deal with somebody and that person then screws you over, you probably are going to have great difficulty in tracking that person down, and hence you are probably not going to want to do business with people. And so from the perspective of a criminal, you are in a world where it's awesome because you're able to avoid law enforcement, but where you may have great difficulty in finding other people to do business with because you don't trust those other people and they don't trust you because you don't know who they are. You can't retaliate if you're cheated and so on.
And we should say that it's also the anonymity which makes it hard for there to be any recourse. And that recourse, dilemma is there also in – it's sort of embedded in the libertarian ideology in some way. I mean, I spent a protracted hour discussing this with a libertarian professor named Walter Block, where – we were talking about what happens if someone steals someone's wallet, and their vision, or I should say his vision, at least from a libertarian perspective, involved his courts, my courts, a third-party court to adjudicate the validity of his court and my court, and then presumably a series of sort of ascending courts, all of whom have only the validity coming from whose court is really seems to be able to solve things. And that there's a quality that exists here with that. And it's not just a middleman of trust, which grows out of this, but also a means in which that middleman to actually have, I guess, some measure, some ability to provide recourse or consequences for a breach of that trust.
Well, I think that that's absolutely right. And let me say two things first of all. First of all, that there are a lot of very smart libertarians out there who also think about these problems in a much more serious and much more nuanced way. And secondly, even when libertarians have crazy utopian ideals, there's nothing wrong with having crazy utopian ideals towards a world in which you can engage in a free exchange without anybody being able to stop you from doing it. This is something that the left, I think, has as well, has these tendencies towards utopianism. But I think that the particular problem with the libertarian conception very often comes from the fact that the real ideal of many, albeit not all libertarians, is market exchange. And markets, in their ideal form, are based on purely impersonal exchange where you do not care who you're doing business with, they do not care who you are, and you're somehow able to consummate and transact these kinds of economic relationships. The problem is that in real life, you need to have somebody out there to try and make sure that you behave in trustworthy ways towards each other. And if you do not have an effective way of doing this, you find yourself in trouble. And this is why some pretty conservative economists, such as Doug North, for example, have argued that having a well-functioning state is incredibly important. Some libertarians would obviously like to try and get away from the state and come up with purely private means of ordering, which you would not have to have any state with enforcement and with the weight of military and police power behind it. But these schemes, by and large, seem to me to collapse and to collapse for fundamental reasons, because they're really trying to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps.
And I want to, I don't want to diverge too much from the story, because we have a lot to cover here. But the notion too that these things, people enter into these market relationships, as you say, that one doesn't care. They're not really personal relationships. It's perfectly fine if they're anonymous, because it's just about the goods. And it's also driven by maximizing, right, the value that someone gets in these markets. So the idea of ripping somebody off, the only consequence in that, in that ideology is that, well, people aren't going to do business with you next time because you're going to get a bad reputation. But the interesting thing about what has happened with Silk Road, and we'll get to that, and we're going to get to that now, is that it's not enough that you have a bad reputation, particularly if you're anonymous. Because,
well,
go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And so what I do in the article, I steal a bunch of ideas from some very smart game theorists. And one of the things that game theorists have discovered, it is possible to run market relations purely on the basis of reputations, but only as long as you have a pretty small pool of people who are interacting with each other. Once the pool gets too large, things begin to get too unwieldy. And so you need some kind of centralized enforcement mechanism in order to make sure that information is properly provided, that people who cheat are properly punished and whatever. And the problem is, of course, that as soon as you start to build up that central organization, you begin to look more like something which is less free-flowing, less libertarian, and you gradually begin to look more and more like a state.
All right. So tell us about Ross Ulbricht.
So Ross Ulbricht is a very interesting character. He is a Texan. He is a very, very strong and committed libertarian. And he is also somebody who's got a secret identity as the Dread Pirate Roberts, a name which fans of The Princess Bride will recognize. He set up a marketplace online called the Silk Road, which was hidden on the secret internet, made a very large amount of money, facilitated a lot of drugs transactions, and has recently been convicted for doing this. He was caught by the feds, and is I believe about to try and appeal and get a new trial. And we will see what happens with that. But as of the moment, is convicted, and convicted on what appears to be some pretty strong evidence.
So talk about how Ulbricht built his business.
Well, he started from a pretty small level. He effectively started as a dealer of hallucinogenic mushrooms. He set himself up. He clearly had been thinking about this for a while. He had been talking to people. His diaries and other material which is available suggest that he had this idea for this online drug market, and he started by selling his own product. The product was clearly pretty popular. He came across as being a relatively trustworthy individual in a environment where a lot of people were not trustworthy, and people started to go to him, and then he started to work less and less selling his own stuff, and started more and more to become a broker between other people, setting up this market, running this market, at first not taking any commission on the deals that he was doing, and then only turning it into a for-profit business model once he had managed to establish sufficient trust in his own reputation, and also by so doing had become a kind of a middleman of trust, as you noted earlier, between these people who otherwise would have had great difficulty in trusting each other.
You post in your piece a comment from the Hidden Wiki that I just love. I feel like it would be unfair if I read it without it first giving you the chance of reading it. But if you don't have it in front of you, I will read it because I think it really sort of shows the dilemma that people had in this instance and sort of what fueled, I guess, the growth of his intermediary business.
Well, this is a guy who was looking to try and find stolen credit card numbers, which is another very popular business that Ulbricht was not involved in. There are these forums for credit card scammers, which tend to be much more focused on professional criminals dealing with other professional criminals than the kind of thing that Ulbricht was doing, where you saw a mixture of dealers and amateurs together. And so you have this comment from a guy in the Hidden Wiki who says, "I have been scammed more than twice now by assholes who say that they're legit when I say that I want to purchase stolen credit cards. I want to do tons of business, but I do not want to be scammed. I wish that there were people who are honest crooks. If anyone could help me out, that would be awesome. I just want to buy one at first so I know that the seller is legit and honest." And so, as you say, I think this is an incredibly funny statement. I just loved it when I first read it. This was the moment at which I knew that I had an article that I wanted to write. But so this guy out there, he's looking for stolen credit card numbers, and he just wishes he could find people who are honest crooks.
And we should reiterate that he capitalized, "Do not, I do not." So in the event that you were about to scam him with a fake set of stolen credit card numbers, understand that those capitals would, of course, stop you dead in your tracks. I mean, you know, the amazing thing about this comment is that's like basically holding up a flag saying, "Incidentally, if you're going to scam me, I'm the guy you're looking for. If you're looking to scam somebody on credit card numbers, I'm the guy you want to scam. Just make sure you give me one good one, and then after that, you'll be in great shape." I imagine this guy or gal has had quite a go of it.
I would imagine, and he posted it in a forum, which is a pretty notorious place for finding sharks of one variety or another. But that also points to one of the ways in which people very often do rip other people off. They build up trust with other people over a period of time, slowly building up a reputation until the moment when they can go for the big hit and basically screw over a whole bunch of money at the whole bunch of people at the same time and flee with their money.
So, inspired by Murray Rothbard, Ulbricht declared his intention to use, quote, "economic theory as a means to abolish the use of coercion and aggression amongst mankind and to build an economic simulation that would let people see what it was like to live in a world without the systemic use of force." And so I guess Silk Road was pretty successful at its height, yes?
Silk Road was making money hand over fist at its height. Now, how much money it was making is hard to say because all of this money was being made in Bitcoin, and the exchange rate at which Bitcoin can get turned into regular money fluctuates wildly and rapidly. But the U.S. government has been selling off various amounts of Bitcoin, which it has seized from Ross Ulbricht's accounts, and we're talking in the tens of millions of dollars at least.
Wow. Okay, and so he basically this was going well, but then what starts to happen?
So I think that this starts going too well in a certain kind of way. That is, if he starts off small and he finds himself becoming this this pirate king of the internet. He names himself the Dread Pirate Roberts after a pirate from the film The Princess Bride. He starts getting grandiose notions about how much money he can make and how at the same time he is forging this fundamentally new set of social relationships which are going to transform everything. He clearly thinks that this is the burgeoning of a new revolution. And so you see mixed in with all of the profit-making activity, you see that he's also engaged in doing things like setting up Murray Rothbard reading groups on the website, is clearly trying to sell a philosophy as well as sell a product. And I think he begins to get sucked into his own fantasy. And I think this is a problem with a lot of libertarians. You see a lot of this in a much milder version. For example, one good version I think of this is Glenn Reynolds, the libertarian blogger, has this wonderfully lunatic book from the late 2000s, An Army of Davids, in which he proposes that there's all of this untapped military expertise and potential out there because of all of these libertarian bloggers who are avid war gamers. And once they are able to unleash their creativity and intelligence upon the world, warfare will never be the same again. And so I think you see something like the same kind of fantasy unfolding in Ross Ulbricht's mind. But because he's making huge amounts of money, because he's getting interviews with Forbes magazine, because he is, in a sense, a minor but very real celebrity, he's also getting affirmation and feedback from the world, which seem to support his fantasies and which seem to support his sense that, in fact, he is changing the world and that he is a world historical figure.
What was the awareness? I mean, he's being interviewed in Forbes. Was it as a guy who's overseeing sort of a site where there's a lot of illicit trafficking going on? I mean, I'm trying to piece in my mind when I became aware of Silk Road and to what extent that was just a function because he got busted. Or when he goes to Forbes, is he? Do people know who he is? I mean, how explicit was all this?
He's already gotten talked up a lot in the press. So really what happens is something like the following. He managed to set this up. It begins to attract attention among computer people, who are interested in Tor, interested in these issues, and a couple of places start to write about him. And the idea of this flourishing drug market being run by this colorful guy beyond the reach of the law, it's clearly a wonderful journalistic story. And so you see journalists beginning to write about it. And then you see questions starting to be asked in the U.S. Senate about why it is that this guy is getting away with this. It becomes a political cause célèbre. And this also has the function of feeding a lot of attention onto the Silk Road, so that if you are somebody who's looking to, I guess, score some drugs and you would like to do so in a reasonably safe way, you hear through the grapevine, because this guy has gotten so much publicity, that you need to fire up the Tor browser and look for the secret address of the Silk Road. And so it becomes a kind of self-perpetuating phenomenon, a kind of feedback loop, which makes the Silk Road bigger and bigger and more controversial until, of course, the controversy begins to eat up the profit model and you see the whole thing crashing to a halt.
And the big vulnerability, as you write about, was that it's one thing for me to go on there and try and buy some drugs, but it has to be delivered to me. So I have to give my address to the drug dealer. And the problem with all this is that now there's some lack of anonymity, and it's up to the drug dealer to, I guess, under the rules of Silk Road, the drug dealer was supposed to get rid of your address immediately, but there was no way to enforce that rule.
That's exactly right. And I think if you look at this, the story of Ross Ulbricht is not of somebody who is a super competent technological hacker. He was clearly quite good at what he did, but he basically taught himself from scratch and made a lot of mistakes along the way. The story is of a guy who is really, really good at getting people to trust him. At one stage, he says, I recognize that your trust in me, to his customers. He says, I recognize that your trust in me is what keeps this site going. He was really good at getting people to trust him and at leveraging that to get them to trust each other. But the fundamental problem with all of this is, as you say, that it's necessary in order to send drugs. You've got to send them by the post, and you do not know whether or not the person who is mailing the drugs to you is or is not keeping tabs on the address that he is sending these stuff too. And very probably he is going to keep tabs because it's going to be simpler for him. It's going to be easier for him to do this. And this creates a major vulnerability because Ross Ulbricht can make rules saying you are not allowed to do this, but there is no real way of enforcing those rules except if a person, as happened indeed once in the Silk Road, admits that they kept a list of addresses, which then gets out through an unexpected means. And so you have this huge vulnerability, and also it's a vulnerability which can be used deliberately in order to try and blackmail and undermine the Silk Road. And that, I think, is when things really begin to start going south for the Silk Road, is when people begin to start doing this kind of stuff.
And we should say, you know, as a drug dealer, it makes absolutely every sense in the world to retain those addresses, not just for convenience, but also you never know what they could be of value to. There's absolutely no value to you to destroy those addresses other than to say there's value in saying, like, I did destroy them, but there's no value in actually destroying them. So what happens then with the friendly chemist?
Okay,
who turns out not to be so friendly. I guess that proves my point. Easier to say you're friendly than actually to be friendly.
Okay, so this is a very messy and very complicated story, and we're not quite sure exactly what happened. But from what we can piece together, it's something like this. Some person who calls himself the friendly chemist says that he needs a lot of money in order to prevent a massive number of addresses being leaked publicly. He has a complicated and convoluted story involving a relationship with another drug dealer, but he also is somebody who clearly actually has has access to the addresses that he says that he has. And so he starts looking to Ross Ulbricht saying, unless you pay me a large amount of money, these addresses are going to get leaked. And so then what happens is that Ulbricht starts getting in contact with somebody else who claims to be a member of the Hells Angels and who gets involved in a conversation with Ross Ulbricht about the possibility of rubbing out friendly chemists and later a few other people who are purportedly collaborators of friendly chemists. And as best as we can tell from the diary entries and from the other evidence that was entered in during the trial, Ulbricht starts getting involved in this conversation with this Hells Angel person, pays a substantial amount of money to get the friendly chemist killed, pays a substantial amount of money to get other people killed, and sees himself as basically as having taken care of what he seems to be pretty cold and dispassionate about, as best as can be told from his diary entries. He's taking care of a business expense. Now, the twist of this tale is that there's no evidence that anybody actually ever was killed as a result of any of this. And perhaps the most plausible explanation is that both friendly chemist and this mysterious figure who offered contract killing, that they are associated in some sense, or may indeed be the same person, masquerading under different identities. Whichever way, Ulbricht pays out a lot of money because he sees the need to plug what is a very, very serious gap in his system.
Now, I'm curious as to the extent that this guy is still doing sort of, I guess, seminars or with Murray Rothbard or promoting the ideology on Silk Road. How does that – I mean, is there any indication that he's sort of drifted a little bit from his intention to use economic theory as a means to abolish the coercion and aggression amongst mankind? Because that seems to me to be – contrary to that, the hiring a hitman to kill somebody who's not following the rules.
It is indeed a contrast, and there is absolutely no connection between the two. On the various Silk Road forums, Dreadpire Roberts, Ross Ulbricht's pseudonym, is maintaining a story of basically that he's a drug-dealing Jesus. You know, so this is a peaceful, wonderful thing in which we will all continue to work together in order to avoid the clutches, what he calls the thieving, murderous myths of the state. And that it is possible to do all of this stuff just relying upon markets and markets alone. And he seems to have some vague ideas that he propounds about how it is that over time markets will emerge in protection as well as in other things. But he really doesn't, you know, he basically argues that there's no reason why we need to fear organizations like his turning into anything like the oppressive state, because they will be disciplined by market incentives not to behave in ways which would lead to their users being harmed or hurt or whatever. Indeed, it turns out that quite secretly he has been engaged in some some pretty cynical efforts, as best as can be told from the evidence that was entered in the trial. He's been engaged in a very deliberate effort to see people who he saw as being dangerous to his business interests get killed.
So has there been any reckoning of this? I mean, the thing I love about your piece is it obviously sort of provides this, I guess, cautionary tale of where this ideology can lead. But has there been any reckoning amongst – I mean, you write, I think, in the piece at one point, like, you know, the Silk Road was part ideologically based and part just sort of about greed. To the extent that there's any remnants of that community that was ideologically based, was there any reckoning with this that like, oh, wow, here is a – really good example of what is problematic about this notion that we don't need for a market to really function on any sort of – to be scalable in any way. We don't need some entity with a monopoly of force.
So far to my knowledge, there has been no serious response in the few weeks that the article has been written and out there. There's been no serious response from libertarians, which frankly comes to me as a surprise because the story of the Dread Pirate Roberts is a catnip. I thought that this was something where I was going to get some good, solid, interesting, provocative counter-arguments from libertarians who would explain to me patiently why I was wrong, why I had gotten this theory wrong, why it was that this kind of order was indeed something that could be maintained without the state. But so far, there's been more or less no response from libertarians whatsoever, which surprised me a little bit. But it may just be that this is a kind of an awkward story. If you want to present yourself as being the people who are going to provide liberty and justice for all, you can maybe kind of reconcile this with having a drug dealer as being a hero, because of course you are somebody who believes that it should be possible for consenting adults to freely buy and sell drugs to each other. But when the guy appears to be a fantasist who's contracting out hits to people who may or may not be actual contract killers on the side, it becomes, I think, a pretty tough sell. So my sense is that libertarians have been sedulously ignoring the story in the hope that this would go away. I do hope that I read some pieces from some of the more interesting and thoughtful and smarter libertarians out there on this, because I would like to see some good arguments starting to get going on this.
Yeah, exactly. And I, you know, it's not a question of of Ulbricht, right? I mean, it's really hard to see how anybody could deal with this. I mean, that's always strikes me as the fundamental flaw in this idea that you don't need anyone other than sort of the market forces to regulate these things, and we see that. I mean, we see it in practice all the time. It's not as sort of a clean sort of illustration as this is, but was there anything in, like, I don't know, forums? I don't know how much time you spend in there, but I mean, I'm just surprised that nobody sort of, there was no reckoning at all with this, that there was no sort of compulsion for someone who was engaged in Silk Road or saw the value of it, you know, from an ideological standpoint. Sort of get out ahead of this and say, oh, here's why that failed. Nothing, right?
It's surprising. And you can see libertarian arguments, especially from people who recognize that there is a role for the state, but they want to keep it as minimal as possible. You can see libertarian arguments that I think could usefully push back against mine. But so far, people, at least to my knowledge, have not done this, or if they have done this, they haven't gone to any lengths to bring it to my attention.
Well, hopefully somebody will do that soon. Henry Farrell, the piece is
linked at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. Genuinely appreciate it.
And thank you very much. This has been a lot of fun.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Beep, boop. There you have it, folks. There you have it. That comment is just too good, right? It really is just, I do not want to be scammed. Now that I have said that, I hope that you will refuse to scam me.
I would love to write a backstory about this guy's, like, his criminal career so far.
The commenter.
Yes.
Yes. That would be the best, right? I mean, that's really...
For some reason,
if there was any way to track that guy down...
Those are words from someone who has been scammed many times before.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Definitely.
That's great.
I just want everyone to know that I do not want to be scammed.
I am looking for an actual Nigerian prince.
That's correct.
Not the fake Nigerian prince.
Dear sir, I am very saddened to hear of your situation... that you have been deposed from the government. However, I guess it is a positive that you happen to come across the $50 million that you have in the National Bank. I am happy to help you, but I want to make something absolutely clear before we continue. I do not want to be ripped off. Now that we've gotten that out of the way...
Three previous Nigerian princes have taken... literally tens of thousands of dollars from me, and I do not plan on repeating the experience.
I realized in going back through my correspondence that I was not clear about not wanting to be scammed. At one point, I think I thought I was implicitly saying I didn't want to be scammed, but I realized I need to be explicit. So now you have your fair warning. I have capitalized it. If you do scam me, sir, I will be upset.
I feel like I really missed out on a big business opportunity, which is basically a business that's scamming these guys.
Yeah.
I mean, you could have really gotten away with it.
I don't think this market is going anywhere anytime soon.
I mean, with the original Silk Road.
Folks,
that is pretty great, though. It's almost like Silk Road will get – no, we'll recreate – it's just like a larger scale version of people that call this show.
I
don't think that was the real libertarian online experiment. I don't think that that's actually who we are.
I think I'm going to make a prediction.
We'll get started again.
I'm going to make a prediction. This program is less than 10 years out from being just an advertisement for our own marketplace, where it is a, maybe we'll call it like the true libertarian marketplace, and where we will engage in this stuff, and I'll be a trust agent for a short period of time. And... folks, I just got IM'd by my sister.
Bilk Road.
Bilk Road. I like that.
I don't even get it. That's great.
I just got
IM'd. Folks, I really want to help you. My name is Sam Cedar.
I want to make it absolutely
inexplicably
clear.
I've begun speaking in this manner as I've launched this venture.
I want to make it absolutely clear. Scammers, you're not allowed here.
We won't have that at Bilk Road.
Yes, had the guy from Silk Road said it in the voice of Clint Eastwood or something. Folks, I just got IM'd by my sister, and she says, perhaps you should tell your listeners that when they vote at podcastawards.com, they should be sure to keep an eye out for a verify your vote email. Some people have to verify their vote, not just a confirmation that you've emailed, but you got to open it up and click, and that's it. And... remember, you can support this program by becoming a member at majority.fm, just pennies a day, literally pennies a day. I mean, a lot of pennies, not so many that you'd want to carry in your pocket, but you'd carry that many dimes in your pocket, no problem. You wouldn't even realize it, probably, three or four dimes.
And then one day when we get enough memberships.
That's right.
Yeah, suckers. It's on a PayPal auto. Right. Okay. Oh, my mic's on.
When we get enough members, we're just going to move to Mexico.
So long, suckers. Enjoy your progressive...
Incidentally,
your progressive notcast.
If when you become a member at majority.fm, I think it's probably in your best interest to write, I do not want to be scammed. Because if you don't write that...
That's a fiduciary responsibility. So as soon as that as soon as that's written in, we actually have to perform our...
in my trials and my travels that if you do not say,
I do not want to be scammed. You have opened yourself up.
You have opened the Pandora's box. I would actually, that would be the funny contrast in the script, is on the other end, the guy selling the fake credit card numbers. Like, wait, hold on, Bob. We got to get him a real card number. He wrote he didn't want to be scammed in the opening graph.
Yeah, we got two lists.
Yeah.
Those people who are not explicit about knowing.
We respect our customers' requests.
That's right. Exactly. Also, you can support this program by going to justcoffee.coop, and this is legit. Justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Get 10% off using the coupon code MAJORITY. This company was supported those union protests back in, 2011 now. Sad what's happened in Wisconsin. Really sad. The Scott Walker has signed the legislation, and unions got to make a transition. But this is going to be tough. It basically says that agency fee no longer necessary to collect. So, technically speaking, unions still remain the same in the private industry, but the employer no longer is required to collect those agency fees for the union having negotiated on behalf of the workers. You know, we're in a new era where, 25th state that has these anti-union laws called so-called right to work. And hopefully we'll see a change in the unions. Nevertheless, justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. And also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link. That's the least you can do at majorityreportkickback.com. You click on the Amazon link. You can bookmark it if you don't want to have to keep going back to majorityreportkickback.com. Well, that's one click difference, I guess. Or you bookmark it as your Amazon link. You buy your stuff through there. You'll notice no difference, but we get a kickback. All right, the number is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. If you want to be a part of the program today, you can IM me at Majority FM on AIM, on your AOL Instant Messenger, any client, frankly, and also, of course, via the app at majorityapp.com. If all goes well, we're going to start our Indiegogo campaign tomorrow, if all goes well. Who knows? There's a combination of, I don't know, a miasma of laziness on, not necessarily on my part, and...
Not necessarily.
Psychological
reluctance.
On it. Oh, I thought you had turned over a new leaf with your, I'm going to, it cop to it.
Oh, I own my laziness. You just would like everybody else to as well.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Mm. You did not say, Sam, you did not want to...
Yeah, Sam, you did not actually say you did not want
we'll be right
work
back.
To be done.